And we are back. Hello and welcome to ATO After the Whistle, the official podcast of the Capital City Supporters Group. I'm Johnny MacArthur. I'm here with Joey, you know, giving you reactions, analysis, and hot takes. Just a quick little aside, very important announcement. Patty has decided to step back from doing the podcast this season for the time being. Him and his wonderful wife, Stephanie, welcome to the world, their daughter, Florence, or Florence, depending on your persuasion. Very recently, she's tiny. I've seen photographs. She could probably fit in my hand. And he will understandably be focusing his time on that. So congratulations to the both of you. And Joey, thank you for stepping up and agreeing to do this. You were already doing the locker room, and now you're full-time on After the Whistle. So welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, it feels good to have run the full gambit of being a fan of the show, from being someone who listened at first to then being a guest writer to then being the co-host of the spinoff, and now being the guest appearance person here until Patrick comes back.
It's great. And, you know, that's kind of, you know, for anyone out there in CCSG that wants to get involved in stuff, this is how it works. You know, how many Capos this year were, you know, just fans that thought the idea would be neat and then volunteered their time and then worked their way into the rotation. I mean, you know, you spot talent and you step up and then things happen. It's great. We love promoting from within. And I mean, Joey was already doing a lot of work on the pod anyways with like research and notes and whatnot. He's far smarter than I am. So it's good having him right on the mic.
Well, I appreciate that, Johnny, but you're the one who makes me sound good when this is all done. So
it is true. I am an audio nerd. So yes, it feels good to be back. Season three, I guess, of the full Look After the Whistle podcast. First time hearing that theme song in a while. I gotta tell you, it gives me the little goosey bumps. How about you?
It's cool. It's the first time I'm listening to it from like this side when it's happening. It's really neat. It's like seeing your name in the opening credits.
So, and you know, how good does it feel to be back in the CPL, baby? What a season we're heading into right now, isn't it?
What a weekend, man. It was so good. It was so needed as well. 167 days is way too long to wait between, you know, one day and the other. And it felt like one long sleep. And here we are. And it's so good to be awake.
It is. And I got this confirmation from Patrick at the friendly a couple weeks ago that it is the longest off season in world football. And, you know, it feels like it, doesn't it?
Yeah. I've honestly never thought about it because I try not to think about the off season, which I keep calling the summer by accident because I'm so ingrained in that kind of football. So,
yeah. And I mean, enough stuff happened to get us through it anyways. I mean, we talked, there's a couple new additions that we actually didn't get to talk about on here because we didn't really have a third locker room like we were planning to. Things happen. But by the last time we spoke on here, we had yet to sign Manny Aparicio or Amir Didic, at least publicly.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? Honestly, I'm sure we'll get to it a little bit later, but great debuts, and I think that's a great way for them to get introduced is to just say, like, you know what? Screw it. Season starts. Here you go. Here are the guys.
Yeah. Well, to speak on our off season, I'm looking at our starting 11 right now, and we had 6 players in our starting 11 that were not in the team last year. And on the bench, we got actually only two new ones on the bench, but yeah, over half of our starting 11 was brand new. So let's just get into this. How did we look on day one with this new look team, in your opinion?
I think the formation looked good on paper. I think everyone looked exactly kind of where we'd expect it to be. I think a lot of the predicted ones coming out or the predicted formations coming out before the game were pretty close to what we ended up getting in the final product. And it's all right. It was good. I think the biggest thing that was kind of obvious to me and clear to me was we struggled very much to play in inclement weather. And that is difficult when TD Place is a valley built in a valley. There's going to be a lot of wind there. And we clearly showed that we can't play in the wind very well.
So why do you think that is? Do you think it's because we don't play on the floor as much as we really should be, and we're playing, you know, volleyball in the air, and then that just, you know, is a recipe for, you know, not working when it's literally raining sideways?
Yeah, I think it's a consequence of having a mix of players who have played on grass their entire lives and now are only playing on turf, and players who have played on turf for their whole lives and know how it works and how to get around it. So once we get the ball in the air and air ball starts playing, the wind takes it, and the wind in Lansdowne can be dominating and unpredictable.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, weather aside, I feel like we very much look like a starting 11 with six brand new players, especially like that first half hour. I was groaning nonstop. I don't think we strung two passes together. The ball was going out of bounds constantly. We absolutely could not play through the press from the back. We were getting overrun in the midfield constantly. It was like, and I was texting during this game, and then someone mentioned, they're like, clearly they are the better team to play with playing together, but we are the more talented team. And I feel like that kind of, like, did you feel that too? Does that make sense? Did you get that vibe?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good way of putting it. That's exactly what we saw yesterday. Mm-hmm. Was a group of talented players who haven't played together much or in any meaningful way, and were unsure of how to string things together against a team that could string things together, but their skill ceiling was well below where ours was.
And, you know, any other day they would have easily won that game. I mean, everyone knows that we should have probably gone into half down 3-0. We did have chances of our own. They were not nearly as good as theirs. I watched the game back again, and it wasn't as bad as I remember the first time. Basically, whenever we got into a position where it was us cycling possession around their 18-yard box, we constantly looked dangerous. Even if it didn't result in shots on target a lot, I saw one scenario where I think we had three low crosses right across the face of goal in a span of like 90 seconds. And I thought we were liable to score at any moment. And even though it doesn't show in the stats because it didn't end up in a shot on target, it was, we had trouble building up from the back and playing through the press. But once we were comfortable cycling around the outside of their box, that's really when our individual talent sort of shone. And look like we could be deadly.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And I think that's you know, part of the reason I brought up the weather earlier is because I truly do think that weird, you know, rain sideways, but not a lot of rain, just enough that it's constant. The wind, the temperature fluctuating, there's a lot going on. Mm-hmm. And like, there were seven big chances created throughout the entire match collectively across both teams. Six of them were missed. That doesn't happen in a game unless there's something else going on. And, you know, a brand new ball, brand new designed ball. This is probably the most water it's ever gotten on it in an actual practical occasion.
Yeah.
You know, live and learn as you're going with new equipment. But chemistry, completely lacking. But to see finishing that bad across both teams, there are other factors involved, and honestly, I'd love to take a look at the mechanics of the ball under the weather it was under, and under the amount of like just sheer water that would have accumulated on it and around it.
I mean, that actually, I mean, come to think of it, like, is there really that? Obviously, neither of us know the answers to this, but I wonder if there's anything different about the ball other than the fact that it's red instead of green. I don't know. Maybe we'll get a chance to look at it at some point. But I know that Austin Ricci would love to blame that miss on the ball. But I think we're looking more at, you know, first game of the season, rust, jitters. That play that led to that shot was ridiculously good. Like, they obviously have a good deal of chemistry in the attack. And I mean, we saw that as well in multiple other chances that they had. Like, they linked up better than us. And, you know, I'm just going to say right now, we're lucky to win that game.
Yeah, we were incredibly lucky to win.
Everybody knows that.
I think the last 20 minutes, we did start to show kind of hints of the chemistry and hints of the play style that's going to come through. A lot of getting as close to the byline as we can before feeding it back into play. I love that. Mm-hmm. Making it so that way the defender has no choice but to either let you go by or give you a corner kick. I know you love corner kicks, so... if that's going to be our play style, we're going to be talking about them lots.
And we only had three of them compared to their seven, which wasn't good. But I know we started with a couple early ones right at the beginning. I think our two of our three were like within the first like 15, 20 minutes or something. And not to be a downer right off the bat, but man, that set was either the first. Yeah, the first corner was short. The second corner, it didn't even hit the first man. It hit the ground first. And I'm like, okay, listen, we didn't sign Amir Didich to hit a corner into the ground on the edge of the 18-yard box. So we gotta make that a better part of our game. Are you going to blame that on the wind, or is that just sort of the notorious hot and cold of what Ollie Bassett's set pieces can look like?
No, I'm going to... That one is just Ollie Bassett shouldn't be our set piece taker. I think he's pretty good at free kicks in a scoring position. Sure, let's let him have those. I think more than enough time has happened that there's more than enough evidence to argue that he shouldn't be taking corners anymore. Because frankly, he's just bad at them, and it's okay to be bad at one part of the sport when you're as good at the other parts as he is. And I understand that he is the type of player who wants to be good at every single part of the game, but it's okay. It's okay not to be the corner taker and be a guy who, you know, scores or is doing other things when the corner comes in.
Or at least
other
just
things to do,
or at least just not all the time, you know. And I mean, it sounds funny to say, because I mean, here's a guy who's literally scored an Olympico off of a corner, mind you, that was 2 years ago. But more often than not, yeah, we're saying things like, "Well, that went right into the first man," and before it wasn't really a big deal because everybody on our team felt like they were under 5'4". But like I just said, we just signed Amir Didich. You need to be hitting that corner at that giant man at near the penalty spot, at the near post, at the far, wherever he is, you have to find him. So I don't really know who's better at corners, to be honest. I don't really know if Aparicio takes corners. I don't know if Debrien takes corners, but I feel like it's a thing that we should probably be experimenting with. Have a rotation. Just because set pieces need to be a part of our game now, because we just signed one of the most specialists to be on the end of the ball in the league. So we'd be crazy not to take advantage of that.
Absolutely. And look at the chances that we did have from free kicks in a scoring position. He had two that he could have taken, and granted, they were close. If they were middle of the season free kicks, they would have been in when he was more dialed in. But that is where he is at his best. That is when he is most able to do things. But every single one of those corners was just, you could see him go to set it up, and I could hear people around me go, "Is Ollie taking it? Is someone else taking it?" Oh, Ollie's taking it. Okay.
Yeah.
And again, it's okay. It's okay. We promise it's okay. Just let someone else take them for a little bit.
Yeah, it is. It's also on kind of on both sides of the set pieces, though, right? I mean, I know the corner that actually resulted in the goal was perfectly placed. It just happened that Brian Wright was standing right in the middle of the box and was ready to head it out. And then obviously Tabler recycling that second ball to send the cross in was what turned into the goal eventually. But like we said, it's more just being hot and cold. Like sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. Speaking of the other side of the set pieces, is it just me, but I am completely terrified every time we give up a corner or a free kick. I don't know what's up with us, but we always seem shaky defending set pieces. Like we're always vulnerable. We almost conceded one off a corner this game, too.
I'm actually less worried about corners, usually. It's free kicks that really, really gets me. And I don't know if that's just a consequence of being a youth coach. And a lot of goals under the age of 16 get scored from free kicks in ridiculous places. I've seen 10-year-olds score free kicks from their own halves because it's just like, "Hey, let's take a free kick." I'm terrified of free kicks, but corners, I'm, you know, especially after signing Didich, I'm confident that he alone can stop most corners. And there was, you know, one that was particularly, you know, scary this time around, but in the end, it didn't come to anything, and I stand by it. Free kicks scary, corners not so much.
I will say that, obviously, on the broadcast, it was, "Oh, he was right there. He just headed too low." And I feel like the dangerousness of that corner was a little overstated, because when you watch it again, I mean, Ingham was right there next to the near post, the far post, sorry. There was no other angle. The rest of the angle would have been caught by, I think it was Sissoko standing on the line. Even if Abatene, I think it was, had caught that cleanly with his head, I still don't think it's going in. But that doesn't change the fact that we absolutely should not be letting someone run completely unmarked to the back post directly where the corner is being kicked to. So this is, you know, I think that the third year in a row now where I feel like our defending of set pieces has not been very good at all. I know all last season we kept talking about getting a set piece coach as if we have the money for that, but it's something we need to work on.
Yeah, for sure. Our set piece marking is one of our most noticeable areas that improvement is clearly necessary, but no steps have been evidently taken to fix it.
Yeah.
Last year and part of the year before, we were complaining about finishing. This year, we signed a bunch of people who should be finishers. We signed people who are ready to score with a commitment to attacking football. Great. Mm-hmm. They've heard that. But set pieces are a big part of football, and we are letting a big part of the game slip by not taking advantage of it.
And especially the defending on set pieces, I feel like I might be way off base here, but I feel like part of this can almost be a parallel symptom of some of our defensive problems when we're only playing with two center backs. Is are we doing too much of like a zonal defense rather than actually a man marking defense? Because I feel like even sometimes just in the passage of play either on the break or even just against the buildup, like I feel like sometimes we just get caught out with players making runs in between defenders and behind defenders. Either we don't know they're there or we're not bothering trying to mark them. We're just trying to mark space instead. Like, does it seem like this to you? Because it seems like that to me sometimes.
We definitely put more of an emphasis on area defense and marking space than we do marking men.
Yeah.
Against a team like Pacific or Valor, who when they're in the box, they've got a couple speedy guys who are moving around. Fine, put your defender in an area that they're most likely to land into and go, or get ready to block channels for faster guys running through the middle. But against a team like York, who can make their formation have three forwards of any width who can then drop down to a forward with two wide wingers or all the way down to midfielders, you have to be prepared to mark people specifically. And when it comes to set pieces, double marking certain players in specific. And we failed that entirely. We continued the emphasis on space. We made no attempt to accommodate what the other side looked like. And, I don't know, chop it up to not having any domestic scouting infrastructure in any meaningful way, or just a commitment to a certain play style or a combination of any other factors. But we failed to read how they were going to be playing that, and we have consistently failed to do so in the past as well.
And I mean, when you're going to be defending space rather than people, it works really well when you have a center back lineup of Sergio Camus, Diego Espejo, and Drew Becky. You can get away with just mark defending space when you have a line of three like that. When you're playing with two center backs, it's not necessarily that simple. And I mean, I love that we're playing with two center backs. I feel like last season our back three, back five was not good at all. And you know, switching to a back four with two flying wing backs, and then you know Zapater maybe dipping back in a little bit is a really good improvement. But we need a different approach to being a center back in that instance.
Yeah, and in my granted very different and limited experience as a coach, I've come to understand that every coach loves to play their own way. They have their own thing that they want to do. I love having three defenders at the back, the middle one being a zonal defender, the other two being man markers in specific. Cargo really likes his two at the back. And when you commit to that as a coach, great. Then you also have to work with your front office and your the rest of the team to actually build around that and commit to that. And our front office, I think, had a different idea of how our defense was going to be played based off of who we signed and when. Mm-hmm. And Cargo is still committing to his two at the back. And again, sometimes you just have to yield to the players you have and change things up a little bit. There are plenty of three at the back formations that will still allow for the wide control play that he wants to play.
Do you think that our overall balance was hurt by the fact that we were insistent on having Zapater, Aparicio, Bassett, Sissoko, and Tabla on the pitch at the same time?
Yes. And I think that could possibly come down to an overextension of promises on game time or X amount of starting games per contract year.
Mm-hmm.
But I think having so many players of like three of them fit this play style and two of them fit this play style and they're different play styles.
Mm-hmm.
I think we overloaded too many players of the same niches mm-hmm. on the pitch at once. We had a lot of opportunities where, if this person came in 20 minutes in instead of playing a full 90, mayhap something else would have happened. But I absolutely think that a lot of the consequence of chemistry issues today came from having too many star players on the field at once.
And obviously, Ollie Bassett playing more out wide on the right. Not more out wide, he was a right winger. And then Sissoko, I'm going to say it. Sissoko was second striker in a 4-4-2. That's what that looked like most of the time to me. He was pushed up higher than Sam Salter most of the game. So when you have players, you know, pushed out in these areas, it's insane to me that in Zapater, Aparicio, Bassett, and Sissoko, we've got four, you know, for CPL, four elite central midfielders. Why are we constantly getting overrun in midfield? Am I crazy?
No. And I think it's, if you look at some of their heat maps, with the exception of Zapater, there are these awkward, you know, V shapes or inverted chevrons going on. Zapater's heat map is a piece of art. It is two parallel lines in the final thirds of each end of the field with one stripe connecting them right through the middle. Incredible. Just a perfect little sideways H. That's exactly what you want from that kind of player.
Yeah.
And then Ollie's got this, you know, right side heavy V shape. Sissoko, you show that to a player and say, what's your position? And they'll just shrug and wander away. That's what his heat map looked like. You just put him on the field and said, all right, buddy, kick the ball. It was hard to watch. And Sissoko did some. He did the exact same thing in the last friendly before the season, where he was, I want to say out of position, but I could not tell you what his position was. So maybe he was in position, Lord knows. And he just, there's so many chances where it's like, oh, if he was right there, where he looks like he should be, and he wasn't. And I feel like there was a lot of those opportunities again on Saturday, where if he was where he should have been on paper, that could have been something, but instead he was gallivanting off somewhere else.
See, but I'm not confident those weren't his instructions in the first place. You know, he did it all game in the friendly and he did it all game in this one too. I'm wondering if he's not being given license to roam for that reason. And see what worries me a bit is that is Zapater enough to cover the middle when both Sissoko and Aparicio are given license to roam? Is that why we're getting caught out on the counter? Because Zapater is the only one left to cover for that?
Yes.
Should Carlos actually be more ruthless and say, all right, listen, Sissoko, you are also, you know, by definition, a defensive midfielder. You may be, you know, a bit more aggressive, being a bit more of a box-to-box, but you can't be hanging up around in the hole in that 10 position or in that second shadow striker position. You got to be at the back at the base next to Zappa. And only one of Aparicio or Bassett should be roaming in front of you guys. And maybe put, you know, an actual right winger on the pitch in Kevin DeSantos. I don't know. I feel like I've made dozens of different starting 11s with this group. And that's the closest to perfection that I've come up with. Not Sissoko drifting up as the second striker, leaving a 38-year-old in the back by himself at the base of the midfield.
Yeah, and again, I think that's a consequence of playing way too many of these, you know, star players at once. And I get it from a business standpoint. It's the first game of the season. It's the first game. Everyone can see them. It's the home opener. It's the marquee match. It's the this. It's the that. It's the whatever. Let's get them out there. Let's do whatever we can. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the weather sucked. Only 4,000 people went to that. Mm-hmm. We're going to have double that minimum next week.
Mm-hmm.
Should have saved it for that and tried to open this one up with an actual tactically sound victory.
Yeah.
Because again, strictly from a business standpoint, if we won on Saturday, if we won Saturday 4-0, because we went out there with a tactically strong team that was prepared and ready to go, then we win 4-0, then 12,000 people come the next Saturday, right? And I do understand the first game, you want to impress and get as many people in the seats as you can, mm-hmm. especially since you spent all this time and money signing these names. But sometimes having all the big names at once doesn't work. And I think that kind of showed. We won, but just barely.
Yeah. And we talk about the need, the want to put all those stars on the field at the same time. And the reason I originally brought that discussion up was because I thought, okay, could we lose one of them and then put a third center back on there? I know a lot of people don't love that idea, but I think having Tuarik and Met and Debrien getting even more license to bomb forward because we've got three of the back would be great. However, when we look at our bench, there was only Tier Walker on the bench. So I understand being reticent to start all three of our signed and healthy and available center backs, leaving none of them on the bench as backup. Do you think that might have been more of the reason why we played the formation that we did?
I think Torres's visa being held up is definitely an issue, if that was the question you were trying to ask without asking it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We made obvious choices in where we wanted to establish depth, and true center backs was not one of those places on the pitch that we needed to set up there in our minds. And we were wrong. We needed more center backs, especially after Wimet's kind of later than usual in the year retirement, which, again, I hope all the best for him and everything that he does. And we really do need another center back.
Yeah.
That's the biggest issue. So if Torres doesn't come in, we need to have a backup plan, and we need to have it established a month ago.
It was pointed out in the there was a clip that went on socials earlier on Monday showing Carlos Gonzalez giving Jonathan Grant the W magnet to put on the board on the back of the door of the dressing room. In that clip was trialist Loic Cloutier, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, who is brought over as a trialist down in Mexico. He's from the CF Montreal under 23 team. He is a center back and also a right back. So he was with us in Mexico, and then we came back. We haven't seen anything of him since, but he was in that video. And someone else pointed out that if you go on the Ligue 1 Quebec website and look at the rosters, Loic Cloutier is actually on the roster for Ottawa South United. So is this a loan that we are going to actually end up bringing in? Is this a signing that we're going to actually end up bringing in? Is this young center back going to be part of, are we just going to have a bunch of young center back depth in him and Tier Walker and Lieberman Torres? And what do you think? What do you make of this?
I'm going to preface this as speculation. Tom, don't come after me. I'm speculating. I wonder if this is some sort of little project that Drew Becky is working on in his new role as whatever his specific title of player development is. This kind of feels like the beginning of like a two-way contract system where maybe he's Montreal on loan to OSU Atletico with the option to be played up or signed here with the option to play down, or he signed directly with OSU Atletico with the ability to be played up and down.
I think it's that, because if he was still with Montreal, he'd be playing with Montreal under 23s in Ligue 1 Quebec and not with OSU Atletico, in my opinion.
Then he would most likely have signed with OSU Atletico. But I truly feel like this is kind of the beginning of the two-way contract system that is present in pretty much every other major North American league system. And I think because right now we're clearly following the North American model more closely than we are the rest of the world model of sports, two-way contracts with development teams are probably inevitable. And if this is the beginning of that, cool. I think this is a great way to experiment with that.
Well, I mean, it's going to see even more appearances of, you know, players like Omar Darwish. I actually want something answered. Is Luca Piccioli an Atletico Ottawa player? We've seen him everywhere at all the events and all the pictures and videos and stuff, but we never announced him or anything like that. And there's the other question, you know, he's a central midfielder. Is there a reason why we've been holding off on bringing him in?
I'm not sure. I think he's probably an OSU Atletico player. Mm-hmm. I think that's the most likely. What I want to have happening right now is them to be building some sort of dream team of two-way players, mm-hmm. something along the lines of what the Blue Jays had in their minor league system with Bichette and Guerrero Jr., where they had that wonder team of four or five kids who came up together, and mm-hmm. by the time they hit the major leagues together, they had phenomenal chemistry and were ready to play and were kick-ass while still being, like, kids. Mm-hmm. I wonder if this is that construction. I wonder if that's what they're starting to build there by bringing in these kids on the quiet so other teams aren't really looking at them that much.
Yeah.
Set them up, get them ready, get them trained in our stuff, and when it's time to get them on the field, boom, chemistry, done. Play style, memorized. Games, won. Let's do this.
I love that example. That's such a perfect example, because I think that's exactly what we're trying to do. I mean, this is like the culmination of all this work with the Powered By program to begin with, is that, you know, we're really farming these youths. And if we're going to bring them to OSU Atletico for the final step before to get actual, you know, meaningful League One Canada game time, then yeah, all for it. So
if there's one thing I've kind of learned, yeah. it's you don't hire someone like Kwesi Leone and keep him on as long as you have, and then give someone like Drew Becky a role specifically about player development, and then not directly sign three of the biggest youth products in your immediate geographical area, unless you have something else going on.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. This conversation actually began because we were talking about the defense and what it could look like. So how do you think we did defensively in this game as far as, you know, tackles, interceptions, blocks? Not a lot is really jumping out at me here.
No, I think there was quite a few slide tackles that I really, really enjoyed. Yeah. I, as a former high school player, have my school board's record for yellow cards, unless that's been supplanted in the last couple of years. I love the ground game, man. I love watching aggressive defense. I love watching beautiful, clean slide tackles, and I saw a lot of those. And that's not something I'm used to seeing from us. I'm used to seeing a little late, kind of choppy tackles. No, this game, and especially in the friendly, blistering, beautiful slide tackles in from nowhere. Clean hits on the ball, and a referee so desperate to call a foul that didn't exist, so we had to let the play continue.
I was going to say, we're talking about all these nice, clean, beautiful tackles, and I'm like, did we forget that we committed 18 fouls to their 7?
Yeah, but did we commit 18 fouls, or did we commit 8 fouls and 10 times we sneezed too hard in the direction of the referee?
I was getting it was a little much, and it wasn't even just that either, and I know we love talking about the refs every single week on this show, but I'm only going to say valid things this time. One thing that really sort of got my goat was the over-refereeing of things as inconsequential as the location of a throw-in or the location of a free kick. I'm like, you're not reffing, you know, an under-9 game here. You know what I mean? Throw-ins are generally the least refereed aspect of this game, along with maybe back passes and things like this. Nobody on the pitch actually gives a gosh darn if the throw-in taker is running an extra 5 to 10 yards up the pitch. It happens every single game, but every single throw-in, which we had a million of, by the way, I don't know what the heck happened there. Obviously, everyone was off the ball, but every single throw-in, we're getting the whistle. No, you got to go back 3 steps. Who cares, my brother in Christ? Nobody. We do not care. You're not coaching kids and like hammering the right way into them. Like, these are grown adults. If nobody's complaining about it, then what's the problem?
I've got two issues with the refereeing. one I'm going to bring up now because it definitely happened this game, and it happens every single game this particular referee is in charge of.
Yeah.
I feel like just out of everything, not going to say the referee's name, just this particular referee.
You can look it up easily.
He gets mobbed every single game. Every game last season, I am fairly certain. I checked the day of the game, and I should have double-checked this morning. Didn't get a chance to, but I'm fairly certain last season, every game he was the head ref. They had to trigger the mobbing the referee clause or whatever it is, because people get in his face. He loses control very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And it's not great. The other thing relating to throw-ins, it didn't happen this game, but I've had seen it happen way too many times in the CPL for a professional league, is somebody doing a small mistake on a throw-in,
mm-hmm.
bad enough that the referee warrants throw-in in the other direction.
Oh, with a foul throw? Oh, man.
Oh, God, that pisses me off so badly. It's such, I hate the rule so much that there have been multiple times coaching youth games where I've just asked if the other team could just redo the throw because it's not worth going through the hassle of having to set up from defense to attack with 9-year-olds. It's just not worth it. Hashtag get rid of the rule.
I totally agree, dude. And honestly, when you're watching a pro league, you might see one of those called a season, right?
Unless it's a CPL. In which case it happens once a week.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous because if you're not like treating it as a set piece scoring opportunity, if you're not doing like the Stoke long throw, then literally nobody on the pitch cares about your technique or form of the throw-in. If you're like close enough, especially when it's like backwards and like 4 feet, like nobody cares, brother. Nobody.
It's so frustrating. And like, I don't know. If you can't control any other aspect of the game, I understand wanting to control where exactly the throw
is. You just hit the nail on the head right there. You mentioned how he loses control of the game, but the things he can control is stuff like, nope, you got to go back 3 feet to take that throw in. Or nope, that free. I literally saw him have a, even when it was the York team, that even when it was York that he was messing with, it's like, no, that free kick has to be taken 3 feet to the right. Like, my brother, please just let them kick the ball.
My favorite one was, I think it was the first free kick Ollie took, the one that was right in front of the dub.
Mm, yeah.
He set the ball on the ground, and the referee motioned for him to move it back like a foot. And Ollie didn't listen. He just rotated the ball a little bit. And the referee blew his whistle and signaled for him to move it back a bit, and Ollie refused to. So the referee manually pushed the ball back a foot and a half. So Ollie picked it up, rotated it, and put it right back where it was. And the referee's like, okay, that's perfect. Let's kick.
Okay, that's perfect. Good process.
And then he went and he sprayed the line on the ground, but didn't bother moving the guys in the wall. So they just stood on the other side of the line.
I remember that. We had to be like, bro, like they're not behind the line. And go, oh my God, what a joke. What a farce.
That was that free kick. He just, he moved the ball, Ollie moved it back, and he went, perfect, let's play.
My God. Anyways, I do want to mention one other thing that's sort of somewhat related to the throw-in, but is also has wider implications on play style. Am I crazy, or is our pitch thinner than it was last season? I think, obviously, a lot of the throw-ins were probably because of all the crazy wind. But I feel like the pitch is just smaller. The technical areas look a lot bigger. I feel like I can see where the line used to be and where it is now. And I know we were crying out for this all last season that maybe we should, especially if we're going to be defensive, maybe we should be playing on a smaller pitch. Do you think they've done that?
I'm picturing it now because I was down on the sidelines for a fair amount of time that game. The technical areas are definitely closer to the wall than they used to be. For those unfamiliar, TD Place has cement walling all the way around the edge of the pitch. The technical spaces used to have a noticeable space before the line started before the wall. It now starts directly at the wall and comes forward. Mm-hmm. But I feel like they're wider as a consequence. The field itself feels like it's the same length it always has been.
Yeah.
definitely more narrow because Twardik was throwing that ball far, like to the point where even he looked surprised sometimes by how far the ball went, which like, you know, been there, man, game recognizes game, but it's definitely some, the dimensions of the technical boxes have certainly changed. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it's because the field has changed, because it definitely felt different, especially with seeing how far Twardik specifically was throwing the ball.
I would love that. I mean, I love, you know, taking advantage of home advantage and really making everything the way that you want it to be. And if Cargo decided that he wanted the pitch to be smaller because we want to make it smaller with our defending, then man, all more power to him. Speaking of throw-ins, does it not bother you when almost all of them result in just conceding possession by throwing it directly at the opposition team? I feel like that happened like 75% of the time.
This might be an incredibly hot take. I've been developing it for about 3 years now, this idea. I really would love to see a professional game played with kick-ins instead of throw-ins.
Oh, like the Wenger suggestion?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, for those unfamiliar with Canadian youth football structure, it's kick-ins until you start playing 9v9, which is typically around U11, 12, 13. So for the first 9 years, 9 to 13 years you're playing soccer, you're playing with kick-ins.
Mm.
And for the first 10 years of that, you're playing with dribble-ins. Mm-hmm. So with the ability to just do kick-ins, completely remove dribble-ins, but I love the idea of being able to essentially just take a free kick, put it on the side of the line. You can screw that up in such royal ways that you can make that work in such beautiful ways. And I think it would alter the game, frankly, in a more fundamentally artistic and skillful way than we must play every second 125 minute regular games.
Yeah, I just hate how easy, you know, how weak they were in giving possession away with throw-ins. And also just with sloppy passing. I mean, let's talk about some of our attacks here, some of our counters, just some of our trying to play through the press. I mean, this is clearly a team that's not very used to playing with each other. And we've said that before. It's a common theme. But is this something that's, you know, inherent in our play style, in our formation? Or do you think this is just chemistry that hasn't been built yet? And the certain partnerships around the pitch.
I think the slow build of chemistry is inherent to the coaches and coaching style that we've had for the last 3 years.
Okay.
Every time we've essentially gone through some level of rebuild every offseason since bringing Cargo in.
Yeah.
And for the first 3-4 weeks, yeah, we're winning games and we're playing, but they're squeaky games. Like there's evidence that there are like loud issues. The brake pads aren't where they're supposed to be. The axle alignment's off. That one headlight keeps going off. You know, there are clearly things wrong, but it's so close to being a working vehicle. And I think that's just how Cargo works. I think we bring in players very staggered. Instead of just like, okay, we'll sign a bunch of them now, we'll bring them all together now, and we can announce them at staggered times. I truly feel like we like signed, brought them in, announced. Signed, brought them in, announced, one at a time. I might just be because I play way too much FM, but I prefer doing 15 deals in one day and then getting that all done and over with.
I said it after that game. You know, if we manage to pull a win out of our ass in circumstances like that and playing like that, I'm very excited to see what this team is capable of when we're actually gelling and firing on all cylinders. Because there were moments there that looked amazing, especially, like I said, when we were the ones in the front foot, we were the ones surrounding their box. It was just the 1-2s between Tabla and Debrienne on one side, the little 1-2s between Ollie Bassett and Twardik on the other side. Obviously, one of them resulted in the cross that resulted in the goal. Seeing players making late runs into the box. Obviously, Aparicio winning the ground duel that led to the second goal. And obviously, Sissoko running late into the box as well, having his big chance on target that led to the first goal. It's just, there's a lot of creativity up front there, more than we've ever had. Like, way more than we've ever had. And it's the sad thing is that I'm not saying Salter's name in any of this. Is this a situation where, like, you know, what do we do about this striker position? What's the problem there? Why isn't he getting into those areas?
when we refused to hire Tom Voldemort as the Defense Against the Dark Arts professor, he cursed the position. And no. I'm really impressed with myself that I remember that much Harry Potter lore. Please there cut that go. Out. No, I think Striker is just an awkward position to play in our setup. I mentioned it before. We like to play wide and long in that width and then play back to a slightly further back central player. It almost feels like we have two wingers, no striker, shadow striker, or floating number nine, right? Completely remove the striker position for a game. Mm-hmm. Do that. Play with two wingers, no striker, no center forward, just an attacking midfielder who can run up and receive the ball. It's risky as hell. It's unconventional, but it's already kind of how we're playing. And if we just set up that way from the beginning and put that striker who typically doesn't do anything for 80 minutes of the game and replace them with a player who could do something, an extra defender or a midfielder who won't make a 38-year-old man do all the work. there's lots of options you can have.
Yeah.
But there's always the conventional idea of you have to have a goalkeeper and you have to have a striker.
Yeah. Well, I know Patrick in his preseason starting, a lot of the writer shed did starting 11s for CCSG, and his had Ollie Bassett playing as a false nine. You know, he almost had like I think he said it was like the Spain in the Euro 2012 type of starting 11. And I'm like, that's a neat idea, man. Whether it's someone like Ollie Bassett or someone like Blue Tabla, because he played out top at some points in 2022 as well. I think that's a friggin' sick idea. Because clearly, like you said, I mean, systems like this, even if you look at like the classic Atletico Madrid teams, I mean, the strikers, the Diego Costas, I mean, these are big, tall bulldogs that do more build up and hold up than, you know, than actual technical, like tapping in the box. You know what I mean? Like that's more their style. So I don't know. I just don't know if Salter's that guy, you know?
Frankly, I don't think Del Campo is either.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like I said, forego tradition, invent something new. You didn't used to be able to dunk in basketball. Then people started doing it. Mm-hmm. Now you can.
Yeah.
Maybe play a game without a striker. See what that's like. Play two incredibly wide wingers and a central attacking midfielder who can wander wherever he wants to go.
Yeah.
Experiment a little bit. For God's sakes, it's still a game at the end of the day. Have a little bit of fun. Go out there and try something new.
And I mean, I know obviously now we're talking the cream of the crop, but I mean, we saw Manchester City win the Premier League without a striker. They played freaking Kevin De Bruyne up top in the middle most of the time as a false nine. So it's very doable. It's something that can be done. Let's talk about standout players. I'm looking at your notes here. You've listed Twardek, and the note here is tall boy go fast. Can you expand on that for me, Joey?
Yeah. Twardek is tall. And he go fast. No, something I really enjoyed watching in the friendly was Twardek play with this very awkward pace where it kind of seems like he's disinterested in what's going on. Mm-hmm. And then when the ball is anywhere near him, he's just boom, gone, lightning. Every quarter mile, faster, 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 man. He's like Lightning McQueen out there because Secretariat's too old of a reference. Like he's fast. He is real fast. Yeah. And there's no stopping him once he gets to the ball. His 500-mile knee slide, first of all, ow, but also incredible, man. And it's because he's the kind of person who has the energy and the commitment and the knowledge and the vision to see what's happening on the field and to get out and to get after it and to not give up. He is committed. He is fast. And that makes him scary and dangerous.
Yeah, no, seeing him overlap with Ollie Bassett on the right was just, and then also being able to put a competent cross in and sometimes cut in and invert instead, it was just, I feel like it's what, you know, it's what we wanted Jean-Ayel Assi to be last season, but he was just not quite mature enough to do that. And I mean, let's, I mean, look at Twardek as well. 2 out of 2 tackles, 1. I mean, you know, Essie could never. You know what I mean? Over 50% ground duels, 1. Over 50% aerial duels is 1 as well. I mean, he's only dribbled past once. 5 defensive actions. You know, here's a guy that scored a goal who was like an offensive dynamo with 5 defensive actions. He's everywhere. And I mean, he's, for me, after a game like that, he's one of the first names in the team sheet immediately.
Oh, absolutely. He also was one of the players to deliver one of those blistering slide tackles that was completely clean. So he's right up there as one of those players that I personally am going to be watching all year.
Yeah. No, I was obsessed with him watching the friendly because we were right down next to the sideline seeing him bomb up and down. This kid is tall. Here's another thing that you won't know until you go to the game. He is probably, we think that like Amir Didic is tall. Obviously, I don't think Twardek is as tall as Didic, but he's like almost.
they stood at the SSM event right before the season started. Mm-hmm. They stood with Twardek right in front of Yesley. Mm-hmm. And that height difference is not as far apart as you think it is.
Yeah.
And Yesley is just as tall as Didic.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple things I feel like he can improve. You know, his passing accuracy was not very great, like 68%. His crossing, you know, he only 1 out of 3 was accurate. But it's almost like, you know, one of his non-accurate crosses led to a goal. Sometimes just getting it into the, you know, a lot of people say put it into the mixer and it's pretty cringy. But I mean, literally, if you're down by the byline, sometimes just getting it into the box is a good idea. Whether it lands on one of our guys' heads, it can land on one of their guys' heads and it still ends up in a goal anyways, because, you know, they can't clear it properly or they don't clear it far enough. And I don't know, there's just a lot to love about this kid's game. And I feel like I don't think he's going to be a right back in a back four all season. I feel like we're going to be tinkering. I think he's probably going to play right wing back at some point once we get a couple more center backs in. I can see him probably playing at right wing at some point as well, depending on the formation we're looking at. But he's just, whatever position he's in, he's going to be front to back on that right flank. It's not really going to matter.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He's going to very quickly become both a key piece of the team and a fan favorite.
Yeah. Oh, he's already a fan favorite.
I think it'll be one of those things where, you know, we talk about it quite often. We never know how long we're going to have Ollie Bassett for. Of all of our players, he is the one who is always kind of like, yeah, he's going to be the one we'll most likely sell for profit or move on to a bigger team. Mm-hmm. I think Twardek is just kind of going to slot right into that place in fans' hearts when time eventually comes.
Yeah, well, he's
already the successor.
Here's a guy that left Canada at what, like 17, 18 probably. This is his first time ever playing back home, and he's 27. And we got him on what, a two plus one. I mean, this could be a situation where he plays the rest of his days here.
You God, know? I hope so.
I really hope so. I'm talking going down as like a Carl Howarth level Ottawa legend. You know, if he really wants to play the rest of his career, especially starting at like 27, if he does like 4 or 5 years here, wouldn't that be incredible?
It's the kind of thing that clubs can build so much off of. It's the kind of thing that creates a legacy, not just for him, but for the club, for the city, for the sport, for so much. Like, just for him, it must feel good to someday have the idea of a kid saying, I'm going to play for Atletico Ottawa because my favorite player, Twardek, played for Atletico Ottawa.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to do. That's what I hope for all of these players. Yeah. And I already know that Ollie has that. I guarantee you Twardek will have that. We'll have that soon.
Now, I realize it's a bit hyperbolic and probably a little bit disrespectful to put Twardek in the same sentence as f***ing Mr. Ottawa Carl Howarth himself. I realize that now, looking back on 30 seconds ago. I'm just
We've grown so much in that time.
I'm just really stoked about this kid. Sorry, Carl. We love you a lot. other standouts, I mean, you know, man of the match himself, Manny Aparicio. What a debut. An assist and a goal. Talk about him.
Oh, my God. It's so good. And again, this some of his stats play into my conspiracy theory that maybe there's been some more changes to the ball than just the color. 53 touches, only 78% accurate passes, but a blistering goal, a phenomenal assist, and it felt like he was involved in so much more than the numbers would actually say. He got dribbled past three times.
Yeah.
But it never felt like that. It never appeared like that. He was everywhere. He was involved in everything. He was doing great. But the numbers say otherwise. And yeah. I don't know. Put that in the evidence file for ball bad.
It's a lot of his numbers are incredible. 4 to 4 tackles, one. It's fantastic. 9 defensive actions. And you know, you want to talk about the ball, only 1 out of 7 accurate long balls. But yes, there are things that I'm looking at here. 12 passes in the final third. Incredible stuff. There are things that I'm looking at here. You know, like you said, only 78% accurate passes, dispossessed twice, dribbled past 3 times, only 4 out of 13 ground duels won, 10 ground duels lost. There's just... It's another one of those examples where it's like, is it enough to just have the one defensive midfielder behind a player like this? Would you feel better having two?
Yeah. You know? Honestly, I want us to start playing with a 3 at the back as soon as we're able to.
Yeah.
I think modern football requires 3 at the back. I think that's just how the consequence of multiple rule changes, multiple style changes, and, you know, the technology changes around the balls between cleats and shin pads, the ball itself, goal line technology. So many changes have occurred. Even offsides are about to change. Mm-hmm. 3 at the back is the way the modern game requires. And the quicker coaches start to play with that and develop it to its absolute maximum, the quicker we can move on to 2 at the back, coming back to the norm.
Yeah. And I mean, especially when your wingbacks are doing, like, both of them had 9 ground duels. Tordic won 5 of them. Mateo only won 2. So, you know, if your, you know, wing backs, your fullbacks are really going to be, you know, sacrifice so much, you know, defensive actions for their offensive actions, then yeah, maybe it'd be nice to have 3 back there. Speaking of one of the old horses back there, Alberto Zapater, what do you make of his game? I mean, just perfect.
Yeah, I've already talked about how much I love his heat map and how I want that. It's just like, there's a tapestry behind me in my little recording space of a soccer net.
Yeah.
I want to replace that with a tapestry of his heat map from the first game. No, I think he did great. 5 tackles, 5 out of 6 ground duels won.
Perfect.
I like those numbers. Mm-hmm. No, I think he did great. Old horse, but he is tried and true. He is still the one you want to bet on. He works hard. He plays harder. He's out there and he's working and he makes the game feel good. And for someone who cannot speak the same language as most of his teammates, I think he was great as captain.
Yeah. No, he absolutely was.
We looked organized. We haven't looked this organized since Drew Becky was a player.
Yeah. No, I agree. And it's like you said, and obviously his English is getting better. But he's just, you know, as the kids say, he's just got this aura, doesn't he? He demands a certain level of respect that really is kind of unprecedented in this league, you know, and to the point we have literally seen opposing fans slander him on Twitter and then have our players go and make them apologize. I've seen this happen. They're like, listen, you must respect this man. And, you know, the experience and the things that he's done in this game is far beyond any player that's ever been in this league. Quite possibly any player that ever will be in this league. He's got captain written all over him. And I mean, in a game that we committed 18 fouls, he committed 0. Talk about, Patrick said it in his player ratings. He said class is permanent. And I mean, that's no more true than talking about this guy.
Bosses command with words, leaders command with actions, and no one encapsulates that better than Alberto Zapater.
Absolutely. El Toro himself. Sorry, I just had a little love bubble moment thinking about him. areas for improvement. You said better preparations for the weather. Sure.
Yeah, again, I fully think we are a team that has we have a stadium that's in a pretty good place weather-wise, mm-hmm. but we face the windward direction 90% of the time. Mm-hmm. It's something that the Red Blacks have to deal with. It's something that we have to deal with. It's something that we have not accommodated well, especially this team. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of times, especially with Nate's long distribution. His short ball, great. His long ball, 45%. Not good.
He's never had a good long ball.
No, but today was even more evident. His overall average was 81% on passes mm-hmm. for accuracy. With long balls, that drops to 45.
Yeah.
That's horrendous. Manny was having a struggle with long balls. Everyone was. And it wasn't just us. It was York struggling. I think, again, the amount of rain we had was weird, coupled with the wind that is trapped in the Lansdowne TD Place Valley, within the Ottawa Valley, within the goddamn flat Canadian Shield. It's a very awkwardly positioned stadium to everything else around it. And you have to get used to the fact that that's what you're playing in. And we just didn't look used to it. So maybe some extra preparations of today's a really shitty day outside. The weather is awful. Cool. 4-hour practice. Let's go outside and get used to it.
Yeah.
Once or twice a year, we have a practice where we play an hour long scrimmage with a bad referee. So that way players are used to, when a referee makes this call, do you argue with him? No, because boom, there's your yellow card. So in the same way that you have to get ready for bad referees, or if this player gets injured, you have to get ready for the weather sucks. This is the uniqueness of our stadium. This is part of the character. You have to get used to it.
You know what? I'm going to hit on that actually right quick, because for me, that's my area of improvement. I feel like, I know it was, you know, not literally a derby match. It was a rivalry match. One of our most heated ones. We've never beat this team at home. Our affairs are always friggin' rowdy, rugged, just dirty. There was way too much risking yellows for dissent in that game. There was way too much, you know, Singh could have been sent off for a second yellow for dissent. The first yellow for dissent was stupid. You know, Manny talked himself into a yellow at one point. It was just, you know, if we're not careful, we don't have a lot of really great depth, right? We can't afford our best players to get suspended for yellow card accumulation. We just can't. We got to keep our heads better.
No, and that's why I go back to saying, sometimes it's worth saying, okay, for today's practice, we are doing nothing but getting used to having a bad referee.
Yeah.
So I'm going to referee the scrimmage today, and I'm going to purposely call every third call incorrectly. Get used to it. It sucks. Yeah. It sucks for the players. It sucks for you. It sucks for if you brought in a volunteer referee for that day. Mm-hmm. It sucks for them. It sucks for everyone involved. Yeah. However, when you get to the game and a referee miscalls something and the other team starts arguing with the referee and your team takes that time to tie their shoe and set up their free kick, you know, one person is more prepared than the other.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's better to just score a goal on them than it is to break their ankle getting a tackle.
Yeah, I love the passion, but we got to control it because I don't want my boys getting sent off for the same. That's just silly. Moment of the match. You know what? We talked about Tordek's knee slide, which you probably saw the picture of him holding the megaphone at the end of the game. His knees looked absolutely shot. Please don't do that again. we love the passion, but now that we have a co-host on this podcast back again who goes to games, tell me what Dub Vibe was like. We're bringing Dub Vibe back to the After the Whistle podcast.
Honestly, it was nice. It felt good to be back in the Dub. It was you know, first day jitters were there. I think there was a lot of new faces, and that was nice. A lot of quiet faces, but again, if it's your first day in that kind of environment, I understand not wanting to be singing along and cheering. It took me 3 games before I started getting chanting. It took me 5 games before I even knew what CCSG was.
Yeah.
So, you know, it takes time. Mm-hmm. And part of it is CCSG is reaching out and getting those people more involved. So if you are someone sitting in the Dub and this happens to be your first episode and you went to the Dub for the first time this weekend, come and find me. I have mutton chops. It's impossible to miss me. I'm down at the front. Find me. I'll teach you the chants. It'll be great. We got to be louder. That's the biggest thing right now. Mm-hmm. Again, weather sucked. And I'm glad that the club has the initiative to be able to comp people into another match if they felt the weather wasn't good enough for that, because that means they're coming back for a match where they are going to be louder.
Yeah.
Because if we can win in crappy environment, we're definitely going to win in good environment, and they're going to want to come and see that. So today I would give Dub 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
I definitely need us to be at a 9 next weekend.
Early season jitters. Obviously, whenever the close-ups came on the camera, it just looked awful. The wind whipping was insane. But I got to say, man, the pop for those two goals from the whole crowd was just unreal on the broadcast. It was unreal. I loved to hear it. So, you know, they're only looking up from there. So I can't wait to hear this little jingle. You know what time it is now.
Woohoo!
It's the mailbag time.
CCSG mailbag.
Mailbag time. This is the part of the podcast. Oh, this is the part that Patty used to say, and I did not prepare for it. This is the part of the podcast where you get to submit your questions, and we read them on air and answer them. It can be anything. It can be a statement. It can be a question. It can just be, you know, complaining about whatever. We don't care. We'll probably say it. And this is just one of the many perks of being a member of Capital City Supporters Group. So speaking of, you know, stretching the limits of what you can put on the mailbag, the first one I have here just says, Chris Twardek got me bricked up. For the love of God. That's it. Okay. Appreciate
that. I'm glad that that was my first mailbag question.
A question, but we appreciate it. moving on. Mailbag question. This definitely won't be unique. It was unique because nobody asked this one, so don't sell yourself short. Which one of our new signings impressed you the most, and which left the most to be desired?
Impressed me the most? Going to go back to Twardek. I think he did great. I've already listed all the reasons why I think he did great, but again, tall boy go fast.
Yep.
I like when tall boy go fast. Who left the most to be desired for me?
It's a tough one, isn't it?
It's a tough one. Is it a cheat to say Luke Singh on his second loan?
I mean,
I don't think he did as bad.
Yes,
as
because we're going to talk about Luke in a bit, because like three people asked questions about Luke, so we'll leave that.
All right. But I'll pick someone else.
But it is tough because honestly, all the debuts were really good, so I don't really think anyone's leaving a lot to be desired. For me, maybe Sissoko Rhone less. And I mean, I loved, you know, you being a crazy man and being up there right next to Seltzer. But, you know, I would kind of like him to be a more deep sitting eight. So maybe that's the only thing I would bring up.
For me, the only thing is I feel like for all of the hype that we've put on him, I feel like Mateo didn't really do much. I feel like he could have done a lot more. I feel like he could have done a lot less. But I also feel like that was probably a purposeful decision to not play on that side of the field by York, which, if I was Martin Nash, and also an asshole, so if I was Martin Nash, I would make sure that Mateo didn't get to play with the ball because, frankly, there were definitely people in the stands there just for him.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they mentioned on the broadcast, and the stats say just as much. He had four headed clearances. That was like equal to what Didich had. He was doing some crazy defensive actions, but yeah, they really shut him down when he wanted to attack. Basically, as soon as he had the ball on that flank, he was just mobbed. So there were some lucky moments further up the field where he got to play 1-2s with Tablet, but that was you know, you can count those on like two fingers. He was not unleashed.
Just to reiterate, so Eddie doesn't come after me, I do not think Mateo did bad. I just think he could have also done a little bit more. He could have done a lot less, but he could have done more.
I'm very much looking forward to what he looks like when he's, you know, he was probably the most shut down player in that game, other than Ollie Bassett, I think.
When his lane is finally open, and it will be open, believe me, he's going to look so good. 100%. So good.
So from zero to good Christ, what has he done? What is the magnitude of the sympathy pains your shins had at the sight of Twardek doing a Didier Drogba slide on the AstroTurf?
Only because I've seen much younger children do much worse injuries, doing much weirder celebrations.
Yeah.
I'm only going to give it a 4 because I have seen much worse. After you see someone lose their tooth to a corner flag,
rough.
Nothing can ever bother you again.
Yeah, that's rough. I will say that he is a lucky boy that he did this in April on an extremely rainy day. I can't imagine how different the scenes would be if this was the middle of August on the hottest, driest day of the year, and what that, you know, hot, dry plastic would have done to his knees. So yes, it could have been worse.
he's definitely got a lot of gravel in his socks still. Yeah.
For sure. A lot of pellets. All right, here's a three bullets in the barrel here. This one's going to hurt, but how many high quality I'm just going to read them all at one go because it's the same question. How many high quality chances is Luke going to give to our opponents before Carlos starts tear over him? Is Luke seeing a liability defensively? He gave away a couple big chances running through the middle and did not impress at all. How many games should we give him to settle back in, or when should we give Tier the nod in his place? And finally, did ATO sign the bad Luke Singh instead of the good Luke Singh could be a problem? That's pretty brutal.
Okay, so I want to preface everything that follows in our conversation here by... Mm-hmm. Everyone needs to calm the hell down. It was the first game and it was in the rain and the wind and all of the other things we have just spent the last 1 hour, 11 minutes, 38 seconds talking about.
Yeah.
Calm down. Mm-hmm. Leave the guy alone. If he does this for six more games, yeah, then let's get this angry about it. But this feels like us as a fan base who is so used to having things to complain about,
yeah,
desperately looking for something to complain about. Mm-hmm. Did he give up high quality chances? Yes, absolutely. Yeah. There's no debating that. So did a lot of players on both sides of the field. And again, seven big chances, six of them missed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fully selling the conspiracy theory that something has changed with the ball and the weather, the rain made it worse.
Yeah,
I think the weather was not prepared for by anybody. I think it was just one of those things where it sucked. The day of sucked.
I'm going to interrupt you here. We're talking about the weather way too much now. We're talking about this guy, yeah, you know, doing gallivanting runs up through the middle of the pitch and losing the ball.
He did that a few times.
These are the real things that people are complaining about, right? And I know when you look, the stats are not bad. You look at the stats, you know, 78% pass accuracy. It's not great, but it's not terrible. You know, one out of one successful dribbles. Didn't expect that. Three clearances, two headed clearances, 100% ground duels, 100% aerial duels, one. Yeah, that's only one of each. But, you know, sometimes a non-active CB is a good CB. But his biggest weaknesses, which I believe are the things that people are complaining about. Yeah, 78% pass accuracy when you're playing out from the back. Not great. And also the gallivanting runs. Like, you're not Joel Matip. You know, if you're not going to have end product to that run, then maybe don't try it. We have way too much talent to bring the ball forward to let a center back, you know, run up the middle of the pitch. And if the long balls are going to only be 43% accurate, then maybe don't hit the long balls either. I am fully aware that one of the long balls actually resulted in one of the goals. But maybe if we're going to be a team that plays out the back and plays a possession football, you need to be laying that ball up to Mateo. You need to be laying that ball up to Zapatero. You need to be laying that ball up to Manny Aparicio. So these are the things I believe that need to be corrected. And these are the things that aren't skill issues, but are formation gelling with your teammates issues.
Yeah, absolutely. What this question here, the one where is he a liability defensively?
Mm-hmm.
No, our formation is open for errors in defense. When I think a big issue that we've brought up multiple times is we have a 38-year-old as the absolute centerpiece of our defense, and we're also expecting him to contribute in the offense.
Yeah.
So is Luke Singh a defensive liability? Just as much as Amir Didic was in defense. His defensive stats were roughly on pace with where Luke's were.
Yeah, they were almost the same. Like, let's be real, they were almost the same.
Our defense just didn't do anything in the match, and that's the issue. And I think it's just we already knew Luke, so we looked at Luke and we clinged to it. I think our defense just didn't do anything, and I think there was a lot more to it than just there was a skill issue with him. I think he has plenty of time before we need to start worrying.
Yep.
But I think Tier should still be starting. but in a three at the back grouping, and it's because we don't have anybody else.
Yeah, you made a really great point. His stats compared to Didich were almost exactly the same. Didich also had 78% pass accuracy, 45% accurate long balls instead of 43. Big deal. 1-on-1 tackles won, 1 ground duel won, but 2 aerial duels won. It's almost the exact same, but because Didich is the big sexy new signing, we think he had an incredible game and Luke Singh had a crap game. And I know that we were saying the bad parts of Luke Singh's games aren't being shown by the stats. But at the end of the day, the bad parts of his game, like we said, it's not a skill issue. It's more just a growing into this team and growing into this new style of playing issue. And, you know, if we bring in Lieberman Torres and we bring in Loic Cloutier, then we're probably going to see Tier Walker sitting in the middle of a three-man defense. And I think both Didich and Singh are going to look really good if they're part of a three at the back on either side.
Yeah, I think just my biggest thing is there's no need to get this upset after only 98 minutes of football.
Agree. Here's one. Do Tabla and Bassett track back enough to cover the wingbacks?
No. And then they never have.
Yeah.
And they never will.
And they never will.
And they won't. But that's just, it's always been that way. It's a consequence of our style and how we play. And again, to keep pumping an empty well at this point, three at the back. That sound was me demonstrating go wider. Sorry.
I get it. I did see Ollie bust in a lung to get back a couple times. Didn't see Tabla doing it, but I did see Ollie do it a couple times. So, I mean, he was just a bit of a fish out of water. So maybe that was him making up for maybe not knowing exactly what his role was supposed to be at right wing, I suppose.
Yeah.
Not completely sure.
Yeah. You know, I think them not tracking back isn't a concern because it's never been a thing that we did, but it's just going to require changes in other parts of the pitch.
Yeah. And I mean, I do remember seeing Sissoko track back. I mean, that guy is just an engine. So if you've got, you know, you can have your luxury players like Tabla that don't, I suppose everyone has them, but you can't have, you know, we can't be having four of them not do that, I guess, moving forward. But I mean, this is all just playing with one another and figuring out how you're supposed to fit on the pitch, I think. Actually, this is kind of to do with the last one. I would like your opinions on playing Bassett out of position. Do you guys think it's the right move to take advantage of his strengths and maximize the talent on the field? Or is the shifting of Sissoko / Bassett when in possession too involved to allow to seamless transition?
I've mentioned it before. I think this is the perfect place to mention it again. We have too many niche players at a time on the field.
Yeah.
We have all of these names at a time. And I think because of the way that they both play, with also having Manny on the field, it's a hat on a hat on a hat.
Yeah.
It's a little too redundant. One of those three needs to be on the bench.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a skill issue. It's not anything else other than just it doesn't work because they overlap each other in too many areas to necessitate having all three on the field.
Yeah. I can see that. I mean, I could also see fitting all those midfielders. The only way I could see it possibly working is playing like a 4-4-2 diamond. But instead, we've done the crazy thing by picking the one midfielder that can potentially, you know, double up in the base of the midfield to be a defensive midfielder. We've let him roam all the way up into second striker. So it's just a bit friggin' cuckoo out there. So I mean, Cargo's a pragmatic coach. He's looking at what's happening, and I assume we're going to see a lot of tinkering and course correction in the coming weeks. Ingham gave away a soft ball with his bad punch. I believe we're talking about the punch that basically went right to Ricci's feet and led to the goal. Otherwise, how secure do you feel with Nate's hands?
I felt like he was punching and parrying a lot more this game than he normally does. Could be a consequence of how York was shooting. They were doing a lot of top of the box shots in.
Mm-hmm.
So needing to punch or needing to parry it away instead of going for a catch or a block is understandable. But I feel like towards the end of last season, he was transitioning to becoming a bit more of a punchy goalkeeper.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the way he's going, maybe as a result of the head injury and recovery he had last year, he's kind of lost some of his ability to make catches as confidently. Mm-hmm. So he's transitioning to punching instead. If that's the way you're going to go, that's fine. Absolutely no reason. Nothing wrong with being a keeper who punches it away. You have to understand and work with your defenders to also have somebody prepared to clear it.
Yeah.
Because four outfield players watched him punch it and then just backed up and opened up a lane for Ricci to shoot.
Yeah. No, that was bad. At the moment he punched that and I see it didn't even leave the box. It's at this level, and you know, this, we're not just talking about keepers here, but even just headed clearances or clearances in general. At this level, you're going to see a lot of clearances where it's like, you know, when you're playing chess, you got to think two moves ahead. They're not thinking two moves ahead. They're just thinking, get it away. They're not thinking about where they're getting it away to. Like too often, instead of, you know, this is on defenders now, but instead of, you know, taking the ball down to the feet and then because you have time, you'll just see an aimless head into the middle of the pitch. And then it just gives possession away. And when you're a defender doing that, then now you have to deal with buildup from the midfield. When you're a keeper doing that, now you have to deal with a first-time shot from Austin Ricci inside the box. So it's, you got to pick your punches. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And the other, I just realized what you said.
I meant it.
I think the other thing that bothered me in that sequence is whatever player was closest to Ricci when he kicked, mm-hmm. he did the 10-year-old classic jump in the air and spin your back towards whoever just kicked the ball at you. I hate that so much, especially when it's like a professional player doing it.
Yeah.
It's not good. The whole sequence was just not fun to watch.
It was a bit last-ditch effort. Yeah. No, it was rough. We didn't win comfortably. We kind of got lucky that York can't hit a target if it spanned the length of the earth. Had it been Cavalry or Forge, we would have been down 2-0 by the first half. Team still needs to gel defensively. On the plus side, the individual quality is astounding. Again, that's not a question, but we agree.
Yeah.
That's good analysis. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, like we said, team needs to gel defensively, but the individual quality is astounding. That's basically, you know, our thesis statement of this episode.
Yeah, I think the other thing, too, is they say if it had been Cavalry or Forge, we would have been down 2-0 by the first half. If it had been York on a sunny day, we would have been down 2-0 in the half.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie to you. It's not making me look forward to having to play Cavalry right after that, this early in the season.
No, no. chemistry needs to develop, and it needs to develop fast, but chemistry needs to develop naturally. If you force it, it'll be worse than having no chemistry.
Oh, definitely.
Having 11 players who hate each other, just let the other team win at that point. Yeah,
basically. Speaking of chemistry, this has some bit to do with that. Back in 2022, remember those better days? Back in 2022, Tabla and Bassett were the main men surrounded by good professionals, and their combination was instrumental in leading us to a championship trophy, which we were delivered 2 years later. In 2024, they are smaller pieces in a much bigger puzzle, with players like Sissoko, Kevin DeSantos, and Manny Aparicio given big roles in the team. The question is, will Bassett and Tabla, not being the only superstars in the team, mean that we see a worse version of them this season?
I honestly hope not. But if it happens, we need to understand that that is something that is up to the coach to take care of and manage and understand.
Yeah.
When you are building a team with names like these, and you're setting up a squad with so many players with an expectation of starting and playing a certain amount of minutes, you need to be mature enough and understanding enough to say, I'm sorry, you're not playing this game for A, B, C, D, E. Or even if it's just one reason or nothing else, then you haven't been doing great in practice. You need to have the maturity and the understanding to do that. And if a player starts to slip because they feel like they are no longer the big name, you need to be on top of that and ready to go.
Yeah.
If it happens, our coaches need to be prepared to get them motivated and get them back to where they were. Otherwise, we're going to end up with a locker room situation similar to where we were for the last six games of the season last year.
Yeah, no, totally agree. I have hope that these ego issues won't be a problem based on basically the idea that what brought all these players here in the first place was the project and the fact that they knew what other names were also being brought in, right? Someone like Ollie Bassett, who I didn't think was going to be back this year. He's on an option year. You know, I thought he might have been done the when Jeremy Gagnon-Laparre first left Halifax, he was like, don't take my option. I want to leave. I thought he would have done that. But he probably stayed because he knew the project that was being built. Someone like Balu Tabla, who, you know, before coming here had, you know, the notorious ego issues. Obviously, he's a much older man now than he was, and he doesn't have those issues anymore. But to come back for a second time, that's a very humbling experience in the first place and shows a lot of maturity and a whole not a lot of ego. And then being sold the project that's being built in front of him, I feel like this is a situation where they know what they signed up for. It's not going to be a situation where they're like, why aren't I playing? I'm the best guy here. They know that they're on a team with Manny Aparicio, with Chris Twardek, with Amir Didic. Like, they know the crazy amount, with Matteo Debrien. They know the crazy amount of firepower that we brought in this year. And, you know, if they wanted to be the main man and the talisman and, you know, big shit on campus, then they probably wouldn't have signed up for this, you know?
Yeah, that's absolutely more than fair. And I honestly, I hope you're right with them knowing and understanding what they're being here. There's also, I hate to play the devil's advocate with it. There's always the possibility of, you know, they signed on because they could work with those names on paper, but then they meet them in person and realize that, oh, our styles are very different.
Yeah.
There's a lot of variables and a lot of options.
Yep.
And I think the biggest thing that the team and us as fans can do is be prepared for what happens if the chemistry doesn't appear and we have big names that can't play together well. Just as much as we should prepare for, we've got big names who can play together very well and will have good chemistry and will win the double and will do all these amazing things. We need to be as prepared for both options to happen.
Yep. And we need to give it time to happen regardless. Because as much as everyone else in the league expects a super team to automatically be dominant, and if they're not, it's a failure. You know, those are expectations that they build up because they kind of hope that we fail. You know, like Eddie said on the hot stove, it's kind of a coping mechanism because they want to be able to point the fingers and laugh and say, ha ha, Ottawa bad, you failed because all of these stars not good immediately, right? Meanwhile, that never happens. You know what I mean? It took the original Galacticos like 3 years to win a trophy. It will take time and we need to have patience. And that's all I have to say about that. Last question. And I love this one because here's a kid that we didn't see on the team sheet, I don't think. And we haven't actually talked about yet. Sacco, Abubakari Sacco, was off for a lot of last season because of an injury. Are we going to see more of him this season? And what are your thoughts?
I've talked about it before on the locker room and on the hot stove. I think our medical team is phenomenal. I think they're one of the best in the league. They've done wonders with the likes of Kevin Allman and Malcolm Shaw. So I'm not super worried about his rehabilitation. I think he's going to come back and come back strong. I really do hope we get to see more of him. And I think the way that our depth lines up, the way our formation lines up, and the way that everything looks, we will be seeing more of him. And I just really hope he brings some of the flair that French football has that he would have just from his upbringing to this league and the unique things that we see French players bring over here with them.
Oh, especially those attacking fullbacks. I mean, you know, like, I know there'll be a lot of questions because, I mean, you know, when you look at the left back depth, we've got three of them. If you want to assume that, you know, obviously Tissot, Matteo Debrien, and then Abubakari Sacco are all left backs. But let's not forget that Sacco's best performance last season was against Valor as a left winger. And obviously we saw Kevin DeSantos come on as left wing depth after Tabla went off in the last game. But, you know, Kevin DeSantos can play all through the front three, the front four. So who's to say we won't see Sacco come in and cover left wing at some point, you know, while Tissot or Debrien is behind him at left back. Or if we see Debrien go up into left wing and then have Sacco at left back, It's just modern football, man. Wingers and wingbacks, there's not that much of a difference these days.
No, I think he's going to end up being one of those bench pieces like Zach Verhoeven, who can come in and close out a game right when we need him. Mm-hmm. He's going to come in and win hearts, win minds, win games. He may not be a starter, but we'll see him just when we need to.
No, actually, that's actually a really great comparison. It's possibly a type of thing that they're thinking. You know, Zach was used to be the golden boy off the bench, and he probably didn't want to be off the bench anymore. So we're like, why don't we just have Sacco come in and take that role? And I will say that the kid looks like he's put on a bunch of muscle this offseason. I know last year we talked about he looked like, you know, his legs were twigs and, you know, he needed to gain about 15, 20 pounds because he was just getting bullied out there. But it looks like he's been hitting the gym. So lots of hopes for his development this year for sure. Good mailbag. First mailbag of the season. It was a banger.
Yeah, I like it.
It was
a
banger.
Fun, fun, fun.
Good introduction. And I know this week I said it, and the same for the next weeks. Just send them to me. Don't send them to Joey. I like Joey being completely surprised by all of them. It's very funny, especially when he just reads that Chris Twardek got me bricked up.
I didn't even look at the question part until, like I think just as the recording started, that's when I pulled it up. Started looking at the questions.
Perfect.
And I was like, okay, cool.
Perfect. To close out, we have some mentions. I want to play you a recorded message from our fearless president, Bryce Crossman, to start this off.
Hello. My name is Bryce Crossman, and I am the president of the Capital City Supporters Group. This past weekend, we had a few people online trying to stir up controversy about members of our group and insinuate things about our group as a whole. Some of these people are unknown to us, and some we have known for a number of years. At present, CCSG is composed of almost 100 diverse individuals, and that number is growing rapidly. We thought that the best response would be to reiterate exactly what CCSG stands for and what each of our members agrees to. So last night, we released this message on all our socials. We, at the Capital City Supporters Group, aim to foster an inclusive and diverse group of individuals who come together for the love of the beautiful game. To do so, we must stand against exclusionary ideologies such as anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, homophobia, transphobia, and racism. We will continue to provide a safe space for everyone to enjoy the sport that we love, in the dub, in the pub, and beyond, to ensure that everyone can safely enjoy football to the fullest extent. If there is ever any issue or concern, we ask that you please reach out to us in order to ensure that your voice is heard and that we can continue to foster a welcoming environment for all. Vamos Atleti.
Very well said, Bryce, and that's about all that we have to say about that. This coming weekend, the Pay What You Can. Normally it's the opener. This year it's the second game. Pay What You Can game this Saturday, April 20th at 2 p.m. against Cavalry FC. Our match partner for this one is Atleti Equal Access. So Equal Access is a great initiative that the club has engaged in. The purpose is to promote accessibility and inclusion in the game of soccer in Ottawa by addressing barriers, especially those faced by underrepresented groups, to provide affordable access to soccer culture, professional soccer matches, and supporting programs that increase access to enjoying and playing the beautiful game. So we'll be partnering with them through the whole season, but they are the partner, especially for this match. So it is Pay What You Can. Hot Stove Wednesdays. This past one was 8 p.m. I believe they're actually, are they going to be 8 p.m. for the whole season? I believe.
As far as I know, 8 p.m.
Cool. It's perfect. It's going to be Wednesdays specifically. So it's not, you know, going to change week to week. Every week, Wednesdays, 8 p.m. We're going to have rotating hosts. It could be Eddie, could be John, could be both. Make sure you tune into those. Make sure you tell all your friends on the opposing teams to tune into those as well. And those actually are being posted on Spotify as a podcast the next morning. I don't know if you've seen that, Joey.
Yeah, I did. It's nicer than, you know, having 24 hours to listen to the recording on Twitter Spaces before it goes away. So X Spaces.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds wrong.
Whatever. Sounds wrong. But yes, no, I tuned in, but I was only able to about half pay attention, but I got the benefit of literally the next morning I woke up and I listened to it on Spotify. So it's all then. And the thing is that it's going to be receipts on receipts now. For things that everyone says, it's all going to be on Spotify to listen to. Also, full-time, a new video program that we have under the TD sign after every match. So Harry's hosting that. And it's going to be, I believe they're going to be posted on YouTube and also clips on Twitter and Instagram. So he's basically doing like a full-time interviews with people that are at the game. Harry is an extremely charismatic interviewer and host. If you've seen any of the clips, they're very funny. It's like our very own, like, you know, Arsenal Fan TV. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's very good. So make sure you tune into that. And if you go to the games, make sure you go see Harry underneath the TD sign after every game. I hope by the end of the season, it's going to be just an absolute mob of people around him just begging to yell into the mic about the nonsense that they just saw on the pitch. the writer's shed is even more massive this year than it was last year. Make sure you read the forward press, the player rankings, the match day in review. We put out actual schedules now, I believe, on our socials showing what's going to come out every day of the week as the week progresses. So you can look forward to stuff now. So that's very good. We have new flags for sale in the merch store. And speaking of the merch, if you are a member, you can become a paid member. $20 a year, I believe, gets you access to exclusive merch. It also funds things like TIFOs and events and domain costs and stuff for our online content. So it gets you access to exclusive merch and also our Discord server where we talk about anything and everything. And it's funny and hilarious and informative. And it's just a really good time. And you'll probably find out stuff a lot earlier there than you would anywhere else. So it's very, very, very worth it. Full member of CCSG. And also we have our ticket link on capitalcitysupporters.com. That's where you can also become a member. So that's how you get tickets in the dub. Same as last year. It's not the little W thing. It's just the button that says tickets at the top of the page. But blah, 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 that was all a mouthful. All right. Joey, first pot of the season in the bag. How do you feel about that one?
Oh, it's pretty good. You know, it's going to be weird not having Patrick here for a little bit, but he'll be back. I hope everyone's okay with me in the meantime.
You killed it, buddy. You killed it.
It's always been fun hanging out with you, Johnny. So I'm going to look forward to the season.
All right. I'll talk to you next week, folks. Bye, most of you.